Our Father in heaven, we recognize and acknowledge that you are the Creator. We take our stand with many over the ages who have acknowledged that you are He who has made us and not we ourselves. And we come to consider this as a fundamental, foundationary truth, which requires us to proclaim it and to preserve it for ourselves and for the next generation. And we ask the Lord for that grace, that we might be able to proclaim this truth in love, but with firmness and dedication to Him who loved us and who gave Himself for us, in whose name we pray. Amen. Well, now let me ask you to turn your Bibles again, as we did last week, to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, those very familiar opening majestic words, which read as follows: In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Our overall theme is this: guarding the foundations. And those foundations are in danger of being shaken. They are under attack. And it behoves us, therefore, as the people of God, to be reminded of what those foundations are and what we are able to do in order to preserve them. Because if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? And so, therefore, it is the plan of this series to give consideration to certain fundamental truths which are necessary for us to define and to defend and to declare in this day in which we're living. Now, the creation, as we noticed last week, is of secondary importance to the Creator, who is mentioned repeatedly throughout this chapter. He is of prime importance. One commentator writes, Genesis is essentially a book where God is prominent and predominant. It is God. It is the Creator. Creation is not an incidental, but certainly let's put things in order, and it is the Creator first, and then secondly, the creation. Now, in this age of science, technology, and the arts, God, not religion, not spirituality, by the way, but God is generally absent from our discussions, except when He becomes an object of sophisticated scorn, superficial satire, or a stopgap substitute for vulgar expletives that we hear around us being uttered and articulated in the office, the workplace, or on the college campus, if not over the media itself. Now, Genesis 1, verse 1, as indeed the whole chapter, but certainly beginning at the beginning, brings before us two spheres of reality. And I want to just consider those two spheres of distinct reality. Now, the one-eyed atheist, the secularist and the materialist, can only see through a jaundiced eye one legitimate reality that is mentioned actually in verse 1, namely the heavens and the earth. This is the object of awe for him. He is inspired by what he observes, by what he hears, by what he tastes, by what he senses in a variety of ways through his senses. And everything is measured by that, and confined to that, the tangible, the temporal, that which is destined ultimately to pass away. But that's the limitation of the world in which he lives, and which he investigates and does research in, and which he takes particular pleasure and delight in pursuing, even in the accumulation of goods and hardware and whatever else. The heavens and the earth. And what we would call that is temporal reality, transitory, fading, fleeting, speedily passing away. It's the world that is all around us. It's the world of commuters, consumers, and computers. We're all linked into that in some way or another. It's the world of fast food, fat bodies, and fitness freaks. And how many there are. We're familiar with this world in other ways, in the pursuit of our pleasures. There's Hoyts and Domino's and Red Rooster, Big Mac and Hungry Jack's. This is the world of reality that we can somehow identify with. Punk stars, Pavarotti, and Pavlovas. I mean the ballerina. It's the world of notepads, iPads, and desk pads, which are all around us, cappuccino, Americano, and espresso, where we love to dine out and to take our friends. It's the reality of dinks. You know what dinks are, double income, no kids. That's the couple who don't want children because they really want a double income and a kind of a lifestyle which they hope to preserve without children getting in the way. But this is the world of dinks and drunks and drug addicts. That's the real world. The world of disaster, dementia, and death. This is the world of reality. It's the world in which we hope to make some profit, pursue some particular kind of pleasure. And we could go on and add to the list of what is past, part, and parcel of this reality. It has its moments of laughter and its moments of lament. Happiness and horror, love, hate, crime, conquests, and rise and fall among nations and among empires. And this reality is confined by the limitations of space and time. We'll talk about time in a moment, but it is measured, and it limits us, and we feel its pressure upon us. It's a world that is confronted by the boundaries of birth and death. It sort of defines the span of life. I'm born, I live X number of years, and then I die. And I go the way of all men. It is a world constricted by our finiteness, our fallenness, and our foolishness, shaped by so much of this. This is the temporal reality. This is the scene, the setting, the background of the life that I live day by day as I go about my tasks and chores and pursue my studies and think about the career and what I'm going to do with my life. I'm born, I live, I die. That's it. It's the kind of timetable reality that we're also aware of. There is a Filipino proverb which says, Westerners are people with gods on their wrists. What's the time? How many of you have been thinking about time already? How many of you, 20 minutes from now, will be looking down for a quick glance at the watch to see how much longer is he going to go on for? How long has he been going on for even now? Kenyans say that Westerners have watches. But no time. When we go and we look for a new watch, we buy watches. And we sport them on our wrists or wherever it may be. And we have them, but we haven't got any time. I've no time for this, I've no time for that. We're always in a hurry. We're being pushed along, as it were. It's a timetable reality, like waiting for a train. British Railway, waiting for the train, as it were, to come along. And there's so many jokes about British Railway. Well, they're never on time. They don't keep the time, which is unusual because they're British. And the British should actually always be on time, but not British Railway. Unless things, of course, have radically changed. Now, Solomon himself was not a Westerner. But he doesn't ignore the flow of time. Remember in that very well-known passage in Ecclesiastes, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. So time is somehow broken up into its own seasons in some way. It's interesting, isn't it, that today in our modern world, our time is not measured by the seasons, but by seconds. Plans are not made by the phases of the new moon, but under the pressure of the next minute. The dawn to dusk pace of life is reduced to the flashing numbers on the dial counting down the time to blast off. I must get out of the house to catch the bus, to catch the train, before I am caught up, maybe, if I were driving my vehicle in some traffic jam with the time passing by and I've got to be in the office at such and such a time. I have an appointment at the clinic at such and such a time. Is it interesting that everything is measured by time? I don't know whether you have heard of the Ferrari FXX. What a car. I'll dream about it, because that's about as far as I can get in thinking about it. It's slick, it's sleek, it's streamlined. Beautiful car. Doesn't cost them much, just a cool, I think, somewhere between 2 to 3 million, I believe. I've seen figures along those lines, 2 to 3 million. And you bought the thing, and it's yours, which very few people have, because they don't make too many of them, not at that price. Not many at that price are going to buy a Ferrari FXX at all. And so you buy it, and you lie in your mind at first until you're well better informed, you might think, hey, this is going to be great. Park it outside the house, you know. Drive down the avenue, you know, in this Ferrari FXX. Go down the highway, nobody's going to catch me, etc. But actually it belongs to Ferrari all the same, because you can't put it in the house, you can't take it home. They in fact look after it for you, and you are permitted on certain occasions throughout the year to get into your vehicle and drive it around the track. And you've paid a cool 200 to 300 million, I can't quite sure, not quite sure what figure it is, but 200 to 300 I've seen, for this car. But it goes fast. Oh, it goes so very fast. 100 milliseconds. That is the line interval between gear changes on the Ferrari FXX. And it seems that it can reach 100 kilometers an hour in just under 2 seconds. Well, now, as I was coming to church this morning in my Toyota Aria down High Street, I thought to myself, well, look, I've got to try this out. And I'm going to sort of, at the traffic lights, if I can get there first before anybody's in front of me, I'm going to put my foot down and see how long it's going to take me to get to 70. I want to get to 100, but I see how I can get to 70. 8, 9 seconds. That wasn't very good, so I had to wait to the next traffic lights. And so I'll try this again. Yeah. Disappointing. I mean, this is an Orion, Toyota Orion. They're fast cars. I didn't even have it in sports gear, and I just had the ordinary and so on. Away it went. This thing, it does up to 100 kilometers now, gets there in under 2 seconds. That is fast. And so they measure the gear changes in milliseconds. In 134 seconds, that's the time taken for light to travel around the Earth's equator, 134 milliseconds. So how many times has it really been going around the equator since we gathered here this morning? And with the blink of an eye. 150 milliseconds, that's the recommended maximum time delay for telephone service. 150 milliseconds. Now I'd like to know that telephone company and the service they provide, you know, that the delays are just 150 milliseconds. my kind of delays seem to be a bit longer than that. A nanosecond is a unit of time equal to 1,000 millionth of a second or 1 billionth of a second, if you can imagine that. Can you think about what that is? Try and conceptualize it in your mind. It's very difficult to do so. A picosecond is 1 trillionth or 1 millionth of 1 millionth of a second. How do you measure these things? The first horse past the winning post wins no longer by a nose, but by a nanosecond. Though the horse with the longest nose may just have the edge. But this is time which we're measuring. Os Guinness, in his book, Prophetic Untimeliness, writes this. He says, ours is a world in which lawyers and psychiatrists charge by the hour. Telephone companies bill by the minute. Television networks charge advertisers by a second. Olympic athletes win or lose by a hundredth of a second, and astronauts execute their life and death maneuvers in nanoseconds. We no longer measure time according to the seasons of the year, but we now come down to seconds just like that. And because of this reality in which we are a part, with the confinement and restrictions of time and space, then we feel something of the tension of time almost daily. I remember reading this when I was just a kid, and I haven't quite forgotten it. It's something which is said by a man called Horace Mann. Lost. Yesterday, somewhere between sunrise and sunset, two golden hours, it's each set with 60 diamond minutes, no reward is offered for they are gone forever. Lost yesterday. How much lost time there is. We lose time, we waste time. It's gone forever. You cannot regain it, you cannot recall it. And we're really sort of obsessed with time, aren't we? Because we're always asking one another, asking ourselves, you say, well, where does time go? I don't have enough time. Give me time. What's the time? It's a race against time. If I have time, I don't have time. On time, behind time, dead on time. Maybe even dead before time. Such is the pressure of time upon all of us in our day in which we live. And this tension, which we feel, reminds us of fleeting, fragile, fast-paced time and of my own swift passing life between birth and death. That reality. For some, this is the only reality, and there is nothing other than that which is measured by the next weekend, the next coffee on the cappuccino strip, the next date that we're going to have, the next job, the next trip, the next appointment, the home for the aged, and then the grave. From birth to death, that's the reality of the world which I am in, and which I measure by my senses. Or maybe in some other way. That's one reality. There are two realities. There is this present, passing reality of life itself, but then there is transcendent reality. There is temporal, time-bound reality, but then there is that transcendent reality. Attention is now drawn not to what transcends reality, but to that reality which transcends all, and which is personal, powerful, and prior to all things. So I'm not saying that this reality transcends reality. It's just, here is another reality. That which is denied by atheists, secularists, materialists, and those who live as if this were the only life. That's for them the only reality. I draw your attention now to a transcendent reality. It's not as if it's the end of reality. It transcends it. It surpasses it. It is supernatural. It is divine reality itself. And it is powerful. It is unseen. It is unending. It is uncreated reality. For my reality that I'm aware of and acquainted with and in tune with is created reality. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But it begins with God, who is the uncreated, unoriginated, unseen reality. And this is that transcendent reality. He is infinite. He is without limitation. Now, this is an aside that I was interested in just thinking about. If you were to count, if it were possible to count all the seconds, or maybe just leave it at the minutes of your life, since the day you were born until this day, how many minutes would you have lived? Well, you can work it out. But then, of course, when you die, time doesn't stop. You get buried. You get buried, as it were, with your watch on. And still the second hand will go on ticking, even though your heart has stopped ticking long, 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 long ago. Goes on. Time goes on. But if you kept on counting, well, let's say, not just from the day when you were born, but from the birth of dawn itself. How many seconds? How many minutes? How many hours? And where is there an end? So my question is, which just comes to my mind, is this, is mathematics infinite? Are numbers infinite? Where is there an end to that? How do you explain it and how do you find it? Well, that's for you to think about over the meal, which you're going to have very shortly. But God himself is infinite. He is without limitation, without restriction, without restraint. And he is invisible. Now, because you cannot see it, doesn't mean to say it doesn't exist. Let me suggest to you that you have a conscience. I hope you have a conscience. All right, so you go to the brain surgeon, and he sort of opens up the top, lifts out the brain, and then where do you find your conscience? Can you handle it? Can you measure it? Can you weigh it? Can you see it? Of course you don't see it. Does it mean that you don't have it? Can you see these things? There is so much that we cannot see unless we are aided by microscopes so that we can see further than the naked eye will take us. Well, before the microscope enabled us to kind of go into such distant parts of the universe or into the depths of the ocean, did these things not exist? Of course they existed. And what there is required is a transformation, very radical and revolutionary, so that we will be able to see what presently we do not see. So the time will come when I will see that which we have been told, but we haven't yet perceived. Even as the ear itself will become attuned in such a way that we will hear sounds and music and song that at present we can only just barely imagine. But God is infinite and invisible, and he is inscrutable. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. Immutable, he is unchangeable. Indispensable, we cannot do without him, and he is independent of all. All created reality exists because God exists. Nothing exists outside of God's will and God's purpose. And because God exists, we exist. But God himself exists in solitude, solitarily, and he exists quite independently of anything and all other. He alone is God, who is the source of every living thing. Now, the biblical view of origins, which traces the source of all things to the will and counsel of this God, acquaints us, as indeed in this chapter, with the supreme government of God. Why do we defend this doctrine of creation and the doctrine of a creator? Well, because among other things, it teaches us about the supreme government of God. He is the God who by his word commands. And you notice in Genesis chapter 1, he commands, let there be light. God who commanded light to shine out of darkness. Let there be a firmament, chapter 1 and verse 6. Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, chapter 1 verse 9. Let the earth bring forth grass, as you have it in verse 11. And so we can go on to verse 14. Then God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. And then in the 21st, then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures. In verse 24, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures. Verse 26, God said, let us make man in our image. Here is a God who commands, and we are introduced to the supreme government of God, and the creation becomes an evidence for the existence of God. The Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1, in those well-known verses found in the first chapter, from verse 18, where he speaks there of the wrath of God that is revealed from heaven, in verse 18 of Romans 1. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in righteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. The fabric of the material universe is that convincing, conclusive evidence staring at us in the face that God exists. What more do you want than this world of reality of which we are a part that has been created? And God has stamped his signature everywhere, from the heights above to the depths below, so that day unto day utter speech, night unto night declares knowledge. The glory of God is manifest everywhere. And all we can see is just simply the creation, not the creator. How did it come to be? How do things exist? You go and buy yourself a motorbike. Well, it just happened. You wave the magic wand and hey, presto, there's your motorbike. It's somehow summered out of nothing. There is an engineer. There is a mechanic. The house that you come to take delight in, it just didn't happen to be. There was an architect and there were draftsmen and there were constructionists and engineers and so on. And here you have it. And we imagine, or we prefer to imagine, that this world in which we live just happened. I was reading just a couple of days ago about a professor in England who is an atheist, but quite an open atheist. It's not that he is simply saying there is no proof for the existence of God. He is saying, I hope God does not exist. I hope he doesn't exist. So that the desire on his own heart is that there can be an explanation which excludes God, because I really don't want God to exist. As I live my life in this world and do so as I please, I don't want to know that there's a God who made me and a God who watches over every step I take and a God whom I'm going to have to face in the last day. I don't want to know that. I want to simply be born to live and die. But you see, there is a God, and he has brought to us clearly, convincingly, the evidence of his existence. Now those, of course, are always asking for us proofs of the evidence of God, that God exists. Here it is. You prove to me that he doesn't exist. What evidence will you bring that God himself does not exist? Here is an exhibition of the majesty of God, his glory and his grandeur. And here we have an extension of his government. Because creation makes it very clear that nature does not rule, only God rules. If nature is left to itself, then it will become unruly. So I don't take out the hoe, I don't use the rake. I've given away my spade. I've had done with gardening for the rest of my days. You come back in 3 weeks' time, 3 months' time, and you just leave everything to take its course quite naturally, what kind of a garden will I have? It will become a wilderness in no time. There are those people who say, let's get back to nature. Not back to God, but back to nature. And we hear references to Mother Nature. And there's the justification of alternative lifestyles, because now we are appealing to nature and we're going to do what just comes naturally. And for me, it is natural to be this. It is natural to be that. I'm going through a bit of an identity crisis at the moment, actually. I'm not quite sure what I am. I know that on my birth certificate, it said I was a boy. I always thought I was a boy. But I'm not sure whether I'm a boy, and hey, I'm going to have to work it out. We're in a state of confusion because we have denied God, we believe in evolution, and therefore anything and everything is acceptable because there is no one who governs and rules and sets in order anything at all. It's just left up to you and me. And so alternative lifestyles are sometimes made with an appeal to nature. I'm just letting nature take its course. And what happens when nature takes its course? It's a return not to the garden, not to paradise, but to the jungle, to the wilderness, to the uncultivated, and to the uncultural. I haven't particularly personally noted that we are rising. I think we are sinking, and that this is a time of decadence and moral, ethical, spiritual drift. Are we being lifted up? And do we see, as it were, the signs of elegance and aspirations for that which is good, lovely, beautiful? I don't believe and see that this 20th and 21st century has surpassed other centuries with their music and their literature and their art. I don't see that. Maybe you do, but I don't. In Genesis 1, we see that things are not left to chance and chaos. There is, from the very outset, the rule of law and the function of government. Because, first of all, there is government by decree. God said, verse 3, God said, let there be light. God saw, verse 4. God called, verse 5. It is God who is saying, speak. It is God who is seeing, observing. It is God who is calling and announcing, and behold, it is very good. It is government by decree. God rules in the heavens. He is enthroned forever. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Psalm 32, verse 6. The well-known words in John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. This is not some depersonalized, faceless, humorless power which somehow brought all things into existence. There is a person, Jesus Christ, behind the creation of all things. Not a philosophy, not a mere principle, but it is the person of the Lord Jesus Christ, the second member of the Godhead, who is the appointed agent through which all things come into existence, and to him we are accountable. In Hebrews 1, verse 1 to 2, God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spoke in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the world. And there are those who will prefer faceless evolution some impersonal, accidental force of nature, which is really akin to fate, rather than bow down before the one whose mind conceived that which would be and summoned it into existence by a mighty act of sovereignty. Government is not only by decree, but government is also by design. So in verses 16 to 18 of chapter 1, then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. The structured universe with its mechanisms and movements meticulously designed to function in a way productive of and preservative of life didn't just happen by some lucky twist of fate. Thankfully, the sun itself is positioned as it is so that we do not, on the one hand, fight to death and on the other hand, freeze to death. And that was not just fortunate and lucky for us. God designed that it should be so, and that there should be the cycle of the seasons. There should be the springtime and the summertime. There should be autumn and harvest, and there should be winter. And that this cycle would go on until the end of time itself. Because God has appointed even the sun and the moon and the stars to regulate, to dictate, to determine, and to somehow rule over even the nations of the earth. Here, Genesis chapter 1 is about government. And why is this an important and fundamental subject? Because you see, there is lawlessness in the land, there is an antinomianism, there are people who are wanting to break free from what they call custom and convention and tradition, and they think that they are somehow modern and hip and up with it, and they're beginning to forge, as it were, different paths and different tracks away from what God Himself ordered and ordained. And if you believe in evolution, then okay, anything is up for grabs. Do what you will. Every man becomes, as it were, a law unto himself, and he does that which pleases him. Government is by decree, government is by design, and government is by delegation. So verse 26 to verse 28 of this chapter, we read, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." God delegates to man authority that he will become vice regent, that he will act as servant and steward and be entrusted with rule that has its limitations placed there by God, but that we might subdue the earth, replenish the earth, manage it as we ought to, and be accountable to our God. And it is God who has himself ordained and appointed what will be, so that all the mechanism within this remarkable earth of ours may harmonize and synchronize, that there may be peace, that there may be happiness. But when sin enters into the world and man says, "I will not have this God to rule over me, I will do my own thing," then somebody tampers with the mechanism, and I can never be sure what time it is. What's the right time? Because someone is fiddling here, and someone is playing with something over here, and somebody is experimenting, and they all believe that it is right, that they can do this and play around with God's order. God has an order. And that's why, you see, in maintaining the foundations, these chapters are so important, because it will talk about family. What is a family? It will talk about marriage. What is marriage? It will talk about sex. What is sex? It will talk about order and relationships that God Himself has defined and declares to be right and just. But man comes along and he tinkers with it. And everything begins to grate. Things no longer work harmoniously. And we find that there is a decay and a disintegration, a crashing of the gears, and there is misery and unhappiness and sadness, and we find that there is a world of broken hearts and broken homes and people who cannot find in this God satisfaction and peace. And so they take to the drink and they take to their drugs. And they think that this so-called preferred alternative lifestyle is that which is going to meet the vacuum within their hearts. And it doesn't. Because we have broken away from God's order. Man is a tenant on God's land. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And we are those who are accountable to the landlord to pay our dues and to pay our taxes. And if we fail to do so, then the landlord has every right to turn us off the land. Man, by an appeal to a false view of origins, has staged a coup in which he proclaims himself as the new ruler who governs, not according to the will of God, but the whim of the creature who seeks to overturn the foundations of legitimate government in the interest of lawless ends, which are an attempt to change the order and to introduce a new world order that changes the view of marriage, of family, of personal identity, who am I, of the value of man, of rights and responsibilities, of good and evil and truth and falsehood. If you deny the Creator, if you deny creation, then anything is permissible. Abortion is permissible. Euthanasia is permissible. Same-sex relationships, transgenderism, eugenics, genocide, and the crucifixion of the Creator Himself, who is God blessed forever. Anything goes. We are called upon in our day, the 21st century, to address this subject, not because it somehow pleases us to dwell upon the beginning of things and tracing of one's roots. We look upon these matters with seriousness, because we must defend them and fight for them in a day when everything is disintegrating and the foundations are in danger of crumbling and falling apart. May God give us the grace, therefore, to renew our conviction and to reaffirm these things, that we may be steadfast and unmovable in spite of all the challenges and the assaults that are being made upon the doctrine of the creation and above all the Creator Himself. And that we may stand firm in defending what God has entrusted to us to defend for His name's sake. Amen.